the investors in the public markets are typically very passive, myopic, and underinformed. That means that what we can utilize is exactly that. Our strategy is designed to use those flaws of the market, if you wish, where we can act as an owner, where the market is myopic, we can think in 5-10 year perspectives, and where the market is highly diversified in the sense owning lots of companies, so nothing is important to them. Private equity is now an incredibly competitive business where almost everyone in private equity is acting the same way. They look the same, they talk the way, they think the same way, they have the same advisors and so on and so forth. Everything is similar, which means, I mean, if you've studied microeconomics, everyone knows that if you have full competition and everyone, there's no edge anywhere, then you won't be able to outperform. And I think that's a little bit where private equity is going. Of course, there will be some private equity funds that are better than others, but we have the benefit that we have not only a high value added strategy, but also with very limited competition.
Activism might be one of the less helpful terms in modern investing, a label that conjures up everything from boardroom bust-ups to terse exchanges between shareholders who are disgruntled and incumbent managements. However, not all activism is equal. And both at our own Money Maze Allocator Summit last year and this year at iConnections in Miami, I've had the chance to observe, understand, and listen to Cevian Capital, Europe's largest dedicated active ownership fund. Their approach has appeared to us to be neither opportunistic nor headline-driven. In fact, publicity-shy and long-term. It appears to be methodical, deeply researched, relentlessly operational. Today, we wanted to test that thesis and understand what activism actually looks like when it's long-term, constructive, and executed with discipline. How does Cevian decide where it can create value? Who do they work with, not against? What does effective stewardship mean in a world where corporate complexity, governance expectations, and capital allocation pressures are rising at once? To help us understand these strands, we'd like to welcome Lars Forberg, co-founder and managing partner of Cevian. Lars, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thanks, Simon.
Right. A voyage from Sweden to Cevian. Just give us the highlights of your journey.
Of my journey? I think maybe a key thing in my life in terms of where I ended up in my work was I studied at the school, Stockholm School of Economics, and I had an exchange in the U.S. at the Ross School of Business. And I read a class called Corporate Governance and Control. And I read a seminal paper by a professor at Harvard called Michael Jensen. He had just written it the year before. This is in 1990. I was reading it. And the headline was, or the name of the paper was, The Eclipse of the Public Corporation. And he basically foresaw the growth of private equity. And I read a lot about private equity at the time. Well, actually, it wasn't called private equity at the time. That word didn't exist. It was called management buyouts and leverage buyouts. I read about that. And then when I came back to Sweden in 1990, end of 1990, I looked for jobs. And I saw that there was a firm that had started within management buyouts. And I called them up and asked them to if they needed someone. And I joined just as the first employee. There were two founders. There was me and there was an assistant. And that's how my investment journey started.
So you and I had a conversation at iConnections in Miami, and you mentioned that when you had got going or early in your career, you'd got to know and you had exchanges with Carl Icahn. Mm-hmm. Now, for those who are not familiar, probably Carl Icahn is one of the most successful hedge fund managers mm-hmm. of all time. Just give us a little context as to why you happened to be talking to him and what you learned from him.
That was probably 8-9 years later. This is now the end of the 90s, in 97, 98, 99, something like that. And my partner, Christer Gardell, and I were running a listed holding company in Sweden where we started the strategy of Cevian. We had not heard the terminology activism at the time. Basically, how we saw it was private equity in public companies. I'm going to ask you a question about Carl, but I want to give this background a bit because when we ran that company, we had both worked together at Nordic Capital in Sweden, private equity firm, and we had looked at a number of listed companies as private equity guys and looked at taking them private. They were sort of good sound companies, but undermanaged to where they could or should be in terms of their operations. So maybe a margin of 10%, whereas competitors were 20% and lower growth than others and so on. So we wanted to take them private. The problem was that in order to do that, to get 90% and squeeze out the minority, you need to pay a very high premium, or which is difficult. You have to pay a high price, or the company was not for sale at all. So then when we were managing Custos in the mid-late 90s, we said, why don't we, instead of taking a company private, we go in, build a position of 5, 10, 15% in a company and run it the way we would have done with a private company. I think about how do we make this company much better over, say, a period of 5, 7 years. So that's sort of the start of our strategy, the activism, as you call it. We didn't know that was activism at the time that it was. To get to your question, actually it was Christer, my partner, who met him on the tennis court through another friend. They got to know each other personally. We had some great investment ideas that we broached with Carl, and he invested and he made some money. And he then also became one of the first investors into our fund when we started Sevian in 2002.
I've got a couple of high-level observations, questions, before we get into the engine room. One is in some of the academic papers that have been written about activism, there have been the observation that it's highly supported by the investment community, number one, and that there is this spillover effect as well, that it helps other companies in the sector. And I wondered, you know, the extent to which academic papers are now being written about this, whether it surprises you and whether you've had any thoughts as you read them.
It doesn't surprise me. There's in the public markets, there's a lack of owners, right? I think this is one of the problems with the public markets, that, you know, when you go to business school, what you learn is that if you're an investor, you should diversify your portfolio. Should be on the, I don't know what it's called, capital asset pricing model. You should sort of diversify it and hundreds of holdings and do something. And this is what pension funds do. This is what mutual funds do, most private family offices and so on and so forth, which is understandable from their perspective. But what it means is that there's a lack of owners of listed companies, right? And that means that everything is fine as long as management board are going in the right direction. But once that's not happening, there is the correction mechanism of making sure that the company, from an owner's perspective, making sure that the company is going direction that's sort of long-term going to be beneficial for owners, that mechanism is not really working. Because the investors in the public markets are typically very passive, myopic, and underinformed. You can come back to why I say that if you want to, but not everyone, of course, but most of them are. And that means that what we can utilize is exactly that. Our strategy is designed to use those flaws of the market, if you wish, where the market is not as an owner. We can act as an owner. Where their market is myopic, we can think in 5, 10 year perspectives. And where the market is highly diversified, in a sense, owning lots of companies, so nothing is important to them. Our strategy is set up that we only make a few investments. We have an average 12 companies in our portfolio and maybe hold them for 5, 6 years on average, making 2 investments a year, which means that everything we do is important to us, right? So we're taking those negatives of the market and turn them in our favor. And of course, that means that we can be that that entity, that owner that comes into a company that is not really doing that well, being the catalyst for change in the right direction, which creates, of course, money for our investors, but for all the shareholders of that company. And since our perspective is that what we want to do is we want to make the companies we invest in sustainably better for the long term, for all the shareholders and all the stakeholders, that means that our intention is, and the outcome is, that the companies become better.
So I'm going to explore a number of those items in 2 seconds. Mm-hmm. But talking about Sevian Capital, give us the high level genesis, growth, locations, assets, employees.
Locations, Stockholm, Zurich, London are the key locations. We invest in northern and west companies in northern and western Europe. The fund size is 16 billion. We are close to 60 people in the firm, out of which 27 people are on the investment team. Quite unusual is that 13 of those are partners with an average tenure at Cevian of 17 years. So we're a pretty broad, wide team that has worked together for a very long time.
Let's talk about one of my bugbears of the industry, which is short-termism. And I know you've written about it. So obviously I smiled when I did because you know, research reports are put out there by investment banks with 6 month targets. And, you know, in some ways you go really, you know, and just as I like to look back a long way, particularly through charts to understand, you know, I'm conscious that it was Winston Churchill who said, you know, the further back you look, the further ahead you can see. Although somebody reminded me, John Paul Getty has said at times of great change, memory is unhelpful. However, just let's think about time frames. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're asked that question, is what do you expect when you invest? We're going to talk about how you get to the investment. Mm. How do you think about time frames?
Certainly not 6 months. I mean, the 6 months question, like as you say, investment banks and others think about, it's like, to me, it's like, how do I forecast a share price of a company 6 months ahead? That's close to 100% psychology of the market and anything like that. And if you try to do something like that, you will be thinking more about what other people think than what you think yourself. We're doing exactly the opposite. We're getting to our own conviction about the future, but we apply that to say 5-10 years. We want to invest in a company with at least a 10-year horizon in terms of understanding what's going to happen to this company and its industry, right? And I think actually that question is much easier to answer, what the true value of a company is going to be, say, 5-7 years from now, rather than, or that kind of time frame, rather than saying what the share price will be. And we know in the long run, the share price will reflect the true value of a company, not in the short run, but in the long run. So if we're looking for not the share price, but we're looking for the true value, we know at one point in time, that's going to be reflected in the share price. So it's an easier thing to do. But the second thing, of course, is combined with our strategy, because we're a change agent. We want to change companies. That does not happen within 6 months. It normally doesn't happen within 3 years. It normally takes 5-7 years to truly change a company from being good to being great, or from being okay to being good.
So that's classic Benjamin Graham without the activism, in terms of the voting and the weighing and the two different approaches that, you know, that describe
define
markets. Yeah. Let's get to the identification and filtering. Low turnover, concentrated portfolio, long term. Mm-hmm. Just talk me through how names get onto your radar screen and how they're filtered.
So we look at companies in, as I said, Western and Northern Europe, where we are, there's our home markets, where we know how things work, governance works, we know people, and so on and so forth, which is quite important since we are, after all, we're an activist, we want to change companies, right? And then you need to be really good working with people, and to work with people, you need to know people well. So that is sort of the geographical area we look for in terms of where the company's based, but mostly they're global companies. We look for industries that we want to own. So we avoid industries where we don't think long-term are attractive for shareholders. We are also very risk-averse. We want to make sure that we have a tailwind in our investments rather than a headwind when we do our change program. That means that many industries fall away because we can't forecast them, or because they might change too much because of technological change or new competitive dynamics and things like that. So industry selection is incredibly important, both in terms of downside protection, but also an ability to, you know, as an owner, make good returns over time. In those industries that we identify as attractive to invest in, we look for companies that are underperforming, even though they might have good products and services, good market global reach, but they're underperforming, typically because of some bad decisions that have been made over the last 5-10 years in terms of how they organize themselves, what the kind of business they do, or they're just not good enough on executing their business. So it could be companies that have, let's say the average of the players in an industry have a 15% EBIT margin, and the company we look at has an 8% margin. Then of course we're looking, okay, it's an attractive industry. The company has a good, actually products that the customers want and are going to want over the next 5-10 years, 15 years. but they're underperforming. If we can, and then that company is also normally trading at a low price, right? Because the laggard in an industry is normally trading at a lower price, both in terms of even on a multiple basis, even though there's sort of potential on the upside. So we then have a company in a attractive industry trading at a low price, and then the question is for us, can we do something about the problems of the company? Can we find a value creation plan that's going to work? And will we be able to implement it? And if that's the case, attractive industry, low initial price, and a broad change program that we can implement, then it's really an investment for us.
Okay, so let's just stay with the industry level. There mm-hmm. is disintermediation all around us. There is, more change perhaps than any of us have experienced as investors. Give us a sense of the industries that are not ones you want to do any work on and those that you feel pretty comfortable have these characteristics you talked about.
Yeah, I mean, we could start with an extreme, like a biotech company, right? Either they find the protein for the molecule for the drug or not, right? We can't forecast it. We're not better than anyone in forecast. We cannot do anything about it. We cannot price it. We don't know what's going to happen. That's not for us. Yeah. It's a clear extreme. But there are other companies that would be, industries that are going through a change where the competitive dynamics are going to change. We don't want to be, where they might change to the worse, right? If they might change to the better, totally fine. But where they might change for the worse, for the entire industry or for the player we're looking at, we'll stay away from it. And we stay away from companies that are too dependent on exogenous factors. Like we're talking now, swings in raw material prices, or maybe companies that have too high, many times companies with too high fixed cost base is problematic and capital investing, where if there's a downturn, you often have to fight for volumes through lowering your prices. We want to make sure that we invest in companies and industries that where our company will have, through a cycle, through whatever happens, good pricing power, i.e. selling something that the customers are willing to pay for a good price for.
So I want to test a thesis on you. So Chris Hone spoke at the Money Maze Allocator. Yeah. Somebody's been a guest twice. He said, and I'll quote him, good companies stay good and bad companies stay bad. And I'm just going to say, please comment.
I understand where he's coming from. And it's a general proposition that's normally correct, right? But on the other hand, what we're doing and what we have been successful in doing is taking companies that are not that great and make them great. And be part of making them great. Of course, it's sort of the management team and the chairman that are the going to do the main job, right? But we're the catalyst of that change and laying out the direction of what's going to happen. So I've seen many situations, many companies in my life that have gone from, that we've been active in where I went on the board, they've gone from a okay company to a great company. So I think as a passive investor, I think that's probably correct. And that's how I would also think as a passive investor, because I wouldn't be able to change it, right? But we are going into companies where other people say we would invest in this if they change, but other people are not the catalyst for that. We're the catalyst for that change, right? We're master of our own destiny, and we can make companies better. So it doesn't mean it's easy. It also means that there are many situations that we shy away from. There can be that we see, okay, this company could become much better, but the process to get there is way too tough and way too risky. And we don't want to take on that risk.
So staying with that screening, the industry identification, I understand. The thesis you've just alluded to, I mm-hmm. also understand. How many companies would you typically, as new potential candidates, would you look at each year?
We monitor a couple of hundred companies. We do that over many years. Typically, when we invest in a company, we have looked at it in depth over maybe a 5 or 15 year period. So it's not that one day we wake up and 3 months later or 6 months later we have made an investment. We track our. We know, as I said, through the funnel, we know which industry and what companies we are monitoring, and we should monitor. And there's a pretty big group of companies that we monitor. And I think one of the key things to be, for us, part of our strategy is to always make sure that we have a pipeline of new investments that are sort of knocking on the door to become better than the investments we have in the portfolio already. Because then you're like, when you always have an alternative where to put the money, you become a better investor, I think. So we do that through a process-oriented force rank, every force ranking process where we force rank the portfolios we now have in the portfolio against the pipeline we have. And when I say the pipeline, I'm not talking about these couple hundred companies. I'm talking about those companies that have those characteristics we talked about, like right industry, but also in terms of underperforming, where we have a change program when the price is low.
So you're comfortable with the industry, you've done the screening, you've narrowed the names, there's a name that you're really interested in, a company that you know well. Mm. Take me through what happens next.
Are you talking about the time where we're basically buying into it?
Yep. Is it buying the shares first, then having the conversation? Is it just, I'd like to understand practically what happens? And it may not happen.
When we start buying into a company, we have spoken to, you know, 100, 150 people in that industry, deep sessions with various players. So if we invest in company A, we have with a very high probability spoken with the CEO of competitor B, competitor C, competitor D across the globe. With the most important customers of the company, with the suppliers of the company, of course, with the incumbent management team, but also so the management team we invest in, but also previous management team members, divisional head members, and so on. So we've done, over many years, done that sort of homework, which means also that the management team of the company we invest in, they know us because they've seen us, they met us a number of times, and we know them before we start buying a single share. So we don't want to buy a share in a company before we have done all of our homework. And we feel that I want to be able to feel that I know what I would do if I were the chairman of the company. You know, activism sometimes to some people mean that, okay, we do one thing in a company and it's fine. You know, spin out a division or something else. I don't know. We don't think that way. We think that we want to have a broad plan of various things, various levers we can do in terms of governance, strategy. Governance is sort of a euphemism for changing board of management, basically, or it could be structure, it could be strategy, operations, and have a view of the entire company. What would we do? Unless we can answer that question, we're not going to invest in the company.
Take me into the CEO's office.
Yes.
You now have bought stock. They'll be aware. You're going to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. You know that company as well as probably anybody else sitting in the boardroom, probably better. How does that conversation flow?
It flows quite well. It flows well. First of all, we met the CEO a number of times before, typically. We will tell the CEO, and he or she has sort of an understanding how we operate. Typically, such a CEO and the chairman of a company, they have spoken to other chairmen and CEOs that we have as sort of running companies where we were the anchor shareholder in the past, right? So they have probably done their homework as well to understand who are we, how do we act, which I think is good. That means that we can have a very factual, non-emotional discussion about where the company should go. We talk about what are the issues we see and what are the things that couldn't be done about them. But, you know, those meetings include a lot of listening rather than talking from our side. It's not that we're getting into the room and saying or sending a letter or posting a letter on the internet or something. We've never done that, you know, saying this is what the company should do. It's a dialogue, right? And I think it's the listening cannot be overestimated how important it is.
As an aside, I know you're quite private because I couldn't find anything about you on LinkedIn, which is unusual and, perhaps a virtue. But you will listen and you will hear things that may or may not surprise you. But you will also have in your mind the levers that you would like to have pulled.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
you're going to meet resistance at some point, I imagine, because those suggestions may not be new to the incumbent management. Mm-hmm. Just flesh out how that, I'm using the word tension in a loose sense, how that typically evolves.
Sometimes there's resistance, sometimes not. And then what we want to do is we focus on the issue at hand, not at the personal issues or personal characteristics or something like that. It's really talking about identifying, first agreeing on, what are the issues? What are the problems, right? And is this company performing as well as it should or not? And that's a very important starting point before you start talking about the solutions. But normally we would join the board of the company and we would work from the inside of the company collegially with the other board members to pursue our agenda, the agenda that makes sense for the company to embark on, that we think. But again, that would be as a board member, yes, we would have an advantage in the sense that we have more information. We would have an advantage or at least a much more skin in the game because we have a big ownership position. But of course, the most, it typically works mostly through the boardroom or in the boardroom. In parallel, there's a discussion. Our board member in the company would have a dialogue, a very close dialogue with the CEO primarily, but also with the chairman often.
Can you give us an example of maybe something that's in your portfolio currently where this process has been going on and where, it's relevant?
I give you an example in ABB. I, of course, want to get to know all the other board members that I'm going to work with. So I was sitting down with one of the board members after I had joined the board. We were sitting in a vegan restaurant in Zurich. And he's a great person, a CEO of a big listed company, global company out of the US. And he said to me, Lars, what do you want me to do for the company? And I said, hey, I want you to think about your board role here as if you own 20% of the company and you are the chairman of the company. What would you do? What would you do? And then push for that. And he looked at me and he's like, wow. And said he thought for a while. There was a pause of maybe 30 seconds or 1 minute. And he said, like, I would do X, I would do Y, I would do Z. I said, great. I think that's exactly what we should do. And I think there's some other things as well. But then he looked at me and said, like, but Lars, I have a day job. This is a transformation. If you want to do this, he said, I'm going to support you. I will support you, but don't expect me to drive this. And I think this shows how, there's a lot of great people on boards of listed companies, really, really good people. They're CEOs that have great experience, achieved a lot of things in their life, or CFOs or similar. But it is their day job, right? It's not their day job. They have other things they want to do. They fly in for meetings maybe six times a year. They can spend a couple of days ahead of every meeting, at best, to understand things. This is my day job. I have a team of two people following ABB on a daily basis, traveling the world, meeting with the competitors, with customers, understanding technology development and so on, giving me that information. So it's like we have an upper hand in the boardroom, but it should not be construed as an upper hand that we can sort of use in pushing our wish on others, but we can contribute in a different way. Also, because for me, it's super important that ABB is going to be a great success. It's maybe a $2 billion investment, 15% of my fund. I'm really going to make sure that this company is going to thrive, right?
Does private equity have an advantage in that it owns the entity typically outright and therefore its powers of execution are simpler?
I think so, yes.
Because you have a private equity approach to a portfolio of listed companies,
yes.
Even though your timelines are, well, maybe they're similar, maybe they're longer actually than the private equity world, but what I suppose intrigues me is when you meet resistance, mm-hmm. And I'd like you just to talk a little bit about how you deal with it. And then as a secondary issue, where for whatever reason, it hasn't worked.
Let's come back to private equity as well, because I think that comparison is interesting, but I'm not going to try and avoid your question here. If we meet resistance, and it cannot be overcome by normal discussions, we think there's something wrong. Something wrong with the people. That doesn't come out right, right? But that there's and you know, that's after a lot of discussion. We might think that no, there should be a change of board. There should be a change of CEO. There should be a change of other people, right? And then we try to move ahead with that. And but again, we do that not in this sort of American activist way of screaming and shouting and embarrassing people, right? It's done in a constructive way. It's behind closed doors. It's done, if it is change of management team, is done collegially in the boardroom normally. If it's change of board members, it's something that is we bring up with the governance committee of the company and move that forward. And we've been able to do these things without ever having a proxy fight. We have been on the board of the vast majority of the companies we've invested in without having a proxy fight. We've made changes to other board members without having a proxy fight or coming into the public domain. And I think that's a testament to partly our style and how we want to operate. It's a testament also to that the governance environment in most parts of Europe is actually quite conducive to our strategy, and it's pretty good environment. But it's also a testament, I think, to our reputation that we've built since 97 of always doing what we think is right for the company rather than something that's good short-term for shareholders. That gives us a lot of credibility, which is important.
So the situations where either you're deeply frustrated or your calculations haven't been right.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about how you've responded.
Well, I think the not being right happens. And this is a reason why when we think about our value creation plan, it should consist of, say, you know, 8 to 12 different important things. Because we know that all of them will not be implemented. We might be wrong. It might be various barriers to doing something. But often we find a couple of other things we can do as well. So we sort of, but that happens, and that, you know, that fact-finding happens sort of with the dialogue in the boardroom or with the management team and the chairman. But that means that we will not invest in a company with just one big idea. And if it works, it's great. If it doesn't work, it's not great. So it's like that. That's how we operate on with the change program. So of course there are, this is difficult. You know, it takes a lot of research. It takes a lot of work, and we don't always get things right. But we get our batting average in terms of our very value creation plans is very high, and I think it's because of our research, but also because I see other people that try to emulate us, trying to raise funds and maybe raising funds, and I look at their change programs and sort of like, and hear about them, and they sound like, you know, some things that would be great on a PowerPoint PowerPoint presentation, but when that PowerPoint presentation hits the real world, it won't work. And I think this is one of the core secret sauces of what we're doing.
So
sort of implementable,
right?
It's practical,
right? So you've had this terrifically high success rate, yeah. But where it has occasionally not worked, how long do you think you might give the opportunity before you say, okay, we have to, you know, move on?
We don't really do that. We are incredibly determined to make it work, and that has been a great benefit. Or we don't give up, and that culture is very strong in what we're doing. It might mean we sort of compromise on something, or we delay something, or we do something else, find ourselves a little bit, we don't give up. That has actually been in one situation, a negative. And the one investment we made that turned out sour 13, 14 years ago to ThyssenKrupp in Germany, we should have given up. We should have given up and sold our shares actually at a gain. We lost money in that investment. And with too much tenacity in a sense and there was resistant political issues, governance issues and other things that made it possible to drive through the change programs at the speed and with the right measures. And a lesson learned for me from that situation was that, okay, our determination is great, but we should sometimes be also be able to walk away from something. We haven't had to thereafter, but it can happen, of course, in the future.
So I want to talk about exits, and this might give you your opportunity to come back to the PE issue that we haven't completely finished on. You own an asset and a company for a number of years. Mm-hmm. The change program is working. The market is recognizing. The valuation uplift is happening. Mm-hmm. What are the typical triggers for the exits? And I mentioned the private equity because, of course, one of the criticisms might be that a good company sits in a PE fund and then it's time to wind up a PE fund. Now, we know we have, you know, all sorts of other mechanisms that are going on for continuation. But mm-hmm. primarily, how do you think about exits?
Mechanically, if you wish, the way it happens is through the force ranking process I talked about, where we have sort of new potential investments that knocking on the door and wanting to come into the as new investments. So it means that we don't have any set target in terms of time or share price or something like that. It's an ongoing process, that force ranking process. And typically the selling process is not problematic. And the reason is and should be that when we enter a company, we play a role, like we're the catalyst. And that's also reflected in when we announce a position or sort of flag for us, like the share price always goes up more than the market, say on average around 5-6%. When we sell out, that doesn't happen, the same price effect in the other direction, because we are and we should be superfluous at that time. We should, if we've done our job, we should be unimportant for the company. The company should have a great strategy, great management team, great board, great prospects. And that's our ultimate goal, of course. And then exit takes care. The exit takes care of itself if we're successful with the value creation plan.
Okay. And the bearishness that perhaps presided at the beginning has now become bullishness. And, you know, bullishness stays until it doesn't work.
Yeah. But and of course, there's timing involved in terms of that you know, the market might the market is goes in, you know, there's a lot of herd mentality in the market and so on. So it's not only this sort of value, the value creation is one driver, but the other thing is also sort of the overall view of the capital markets of the company and the industries we're in.
Have I given you the chance to come back on private equity?
You asked me about if that's a better governance model. In a sense, it is a great governance model because you can really, as an owner, you can influence the company. I think and we try to emulate that in the sense that we, you know, get the board together to, in a companies we're in, to try and think less about quarterly reports, think about how the company is perceived, and think about more what we want to be 5-7 years from now, and sort of really, really go for that target. But I think the advantage we have is that to private equity lies in another area, is that private equity is now an incredibly competitive business where almost everyone in private equity is acting the same way. They look the same. They talk the way. They think the same way. They have the same advisors and so on and so forth. Everything is similar, which means, I mean, if you've studied microeconomics, everyone knows that if you have, you know, full competition and everyone, there's no edge anywhere, then, you know, you won't be able to outperform. And I think that's a little bit where private equity is going. Of course, there will be some private equity funds that are better than others. But we have the benefit that we have not only a high value added strategy, but also with very limited competition.
So bull and bear markets are a part of the natural topography of the world in which we live. And so my question is about alpha and beta. You know, you're trying to find the companies that you describe that will deliver material outperformance versus cash risk-free, the world index. Mm-hmm. What do you say to the question of how should you be benchmarked or judged?
Good question. I think the way we think is absolute returns. That's how we operate, right? And I think it's a great way of working in the public markets. As we talked about, there's a herd mentality out there. Sometimes one industry is in vogue, some kind of companies in vogue, and others are like, so we can use that to get into companies and industries at a time where they're out of fashion, if you wish. That can be used. But over time, of course, we need to beat the index, the market index. Otherwise, we're not adding value to our investors. But that is not, if we were thinking, how do we beat the market this year or next year or 3 years from now, we would be a lousy investor.
Yeah.
I learned this very clearly in 1999 when, 1999, and we had a Swedish-centric investment strategy then. The stock on stock exchange was up 60% that year. And I remember walking through the city of London, of Stockholm in sort of fall of 99, I was thinking like, how should I think about this? We were underperforming. I don't know how much. We were up quite a bit, but I mean, way below those 60%, maybe. And I got to the conclusion that we've been doing a good job. If we had been performing according to market, we would have done a bad job because we would have been highly speculative. So it was a great understanding in the middle of that underperformance to recognize that it's important not to have FOMO when you're an investor.
Yeah.
And then of course we outperformed many years thereafter.
And I'm betting that the reason you underperformed the index was you didn't have Ericsson, just as people in the UK who didn't have Vodafone.
That's one of the key. But it was the overall internet bubble, but that's true. Ericsson was one of them. But there were many other things in the market that sort of led to those 60%.
In reading some of your papers, although you do not invest in the US, you were quite clear that Europe appears quite fertile and probably more fertile than the US. Can you explain if that is the case? And also, is it an easier climate in which to operate when you are discussing change with management?
There's very parts of this question. One is valuation. I think it's, of course, great that European equities are under, are cheaper than the US. If you look like for like, maybe a discount of 30% or something, which is great as an investor. If you buy something, you want to buy it cheaper. That's, if you have a 33% discount, that means if you can close that gap, it's a 50% upside. That's amazing amount of money, right? So it's attractive at this time for that reason. But the other part of your question was more, I think, governance related, if I understood correctly. I think Europe provides all the markets we're in Western Northern Europe, with the exception of Germany, provide a very good governance environment for a engaged owner, for an activist to be involved. There's like true shareholder democracy in the sense that decisions are made at the shareholders meeting by way, typically, 50% majority, which is also true for electing board members. And they're typically elected on an annual basis, not a staggered basis. So it gives us the governance tools in Europe are very conducive to what we're doing.
When we started this conversation, you gave quite a good description of the problems of the public markets, mm-hmm. which are not exclusively, but to some large degree, have not been helped by passive and the lack of investor interest. Mm-hmm. Just look forward. This is a non-Sevian question, but mm-hmm. how might with the euphoria that surrounded private equity that is now being checked and the disappointment in some, listed stock markets outside of the US. How might we roll forward here in the influence of private versus public markets?
I mean, I left the private equity industry in 97. I was a bit too early to think that it was going to be coming too competitive, right? It's like, it's been up until maybe 10 years ago, quite an attractive market. I think it's less attractive now for sure. because of the amount of competition. I also think maybe investors in private equity fool themselves when they think it's a more stable asset class because it's sort of marked in a different way than the public market, especially since actually the private equity investments are typically geared much more than the public companies. And so it's much more volatile and therefore can also, but it can sort of continue to do well for longer before problems are really seen because of how things are marked. So I think I would be a bit vigilant or close to paranoid if I invested in private equity and think about, you know, what's really underlying in terms of assets.
Yeah, vigilance.
We are, you know, we have no leverage. We have no shorting, no funny financial instruments. The companies we invest in, we actually, they're typically over time become better capitalized. The net debt to EBITDA today of our portfolio is about 1.3, much more, much better capitalized than the overall market. We are, as a firm, very risk averse. We want our return to come from astute investment decisions, but primarily from the change programs of our companies, right? And we want to be strong when others are weak. That has helped us in many situations in the past. As you say, there are bull and bear markets, and we survived many bear markets. Actually, we thrived through those and made very good investment decisions in the bear markets and can utilize them. And if you're levered, that's very difficult. If you have money that's short-term in your fund, that's also very difficult. So we sort of put our structure up in a way where we can be utilize those times when the markets are down.
If I'd been in a lecture room and I'd listened to you reflect on your business, I suppose my question would be, why aren't more people doing it?
Yeah, if you'd asked me 20 years ago, I would think there would be we would have many, many competitors. I'm a bit surprised myself. I mean, there's every year there are some people that start funds or try to start funds that are similar to us. But, you know, there's an issue, a little bit chicken and an egg issue. To be successful in what we do, you need to have a lot of capital and you need to have it tied up. And you need to have a reputation, sort of good reputation, a solid track record, both in order to raise money, but also especially to raise long-term money. And it's a chicken and egg thing. It's very difficult to get there.
So, Lars, I'm going to move towards some concluding questions, but two things have sort of stayed with me is that you've been at this for 20 years. Mm-hmm. The environment's changed, as evidenced by that survey I mentioned early on. Activism, as you practice it, would have been quite alien when you started out. How would you describe the landscape and the responsiveness of investors since you began?
It's changed quite a bit, for sure. I mean, we're talking, actually, when we started with the strategy, this was a few years before Cevian even, so this is 96, 97. It's almost, it's 30 years ago. And we were the new kids on the block. We were coming into public companies. This was started in Sweden. And these guys are coming in and saying that this is not good enough. Things should change. And of course, we had to prepare immensely for this in order to win those battles, win those discussions and have people support us. Because if you're a minority investor, as we are, you have 5, 10, 15% in the company. Basically, the power comes from three different things, right? One is you have to identify the problem of a company. There has to be a problem. But you also have to have a solution that works. And that means that and then you have to have credibility. These things you need to have in power. I mean, it's politics, but for our strategy as well. So we had to do very, very deep research on identifying the problem of a company and very, very deep research on making sure that we found the solutions that would really work. Because we were, as I said, we were new to the game. Yes, we were experienced in some ways in private equity and consulting and other things, but not in that role. And I think that was great for us to have this sort of very tough bar to get to, because it made us really work incredibly hard to to find answers to these questions, the problem and the solution. And the credibility came then as a consequence of our handle the two. And over time, of course, 70 investments since, the credibility part is much easier. It doesn't mean we become sloppy with the other research, but the credibility is easier because we've been working for the benefit of all stakeholders, as we talked about the entire time. But it was tough at the outset. And, you know, I remember there's also, of course, working again. I remember a couple of the first investments we made in continental Europe. And one was Panalpina, and another one was Munich Re. Panalpina, freight forwarder in Switzerland, and Munich Re, the leader in reinsurance in the world in Munich. And in both these cases, and we had, you know, as we talked about, I interacted with management a lot beforehand and so on and so forth. And then our stake was announced. And then in the case of Panalpina, the CFO, Marco Gadola, a really good guy, he called me and said, "Lars, it's very interesting. I'm getting all these investment banks calling me and they're sending me a lot of presentations on you guys and how problematic you are and why they need a defense advisor." But he said, "We know each other. We don't need a defense advisor, do we?" And I said, "No, of course you don't." And they said, "Actually, Lars, I'm going to send you these reports." And so he sent me those reports, that the defense advisors had sent to the company to try and get their business, right? And of course, painting us as a, you know, problematic or short-term or something like that in order to sort of try to create some tension, the same way that journalists did at the outset of our business as well, saying that there's tension, the interests are not aligned and so on and so forth. But we're past that phase. Actually, the same thing happened with Jörg Schneider, the CFO, also a very good guy. At Munich Re, he said, "I have all these defense advisors talking to me. Can we talk about some things?" And then he flew to Zurich the same day and we met. We had dinner together and we hashed some things out and fine. We had a very good cooperation.
So the final question that I want to ask you is thinking and listening to what you said today. And if I just jogged back to the case of ABB, I mean, I remember reading essentially the case study. I think you took their margins and over that period, you know, helped them get their margins doubled, evaluation followed, and it was a terrific uplift, you know, across the board. Mm-hmm. There would be an argument that some of what was done and can be done can be helped courtesy of AI. To what extent is AI useful or even a competitor to your approach?
How would it be done by AI, do you mean?
Yes, because if you're diagnosing the problem of a company, you know, if I put into Claude, my margins are 11%, I need to get them up to the industry standards.
Yes. But I mean, that's sort of that's the very superficial thing that anyone can see. I mean, actually, this is interesting. There's like many, the companies we identify, other people also see that they're underperforming, that things should be done, that strategies should be different. It's just that they don't have the business model or the bandwidth to do the work or to get into it or be the catalyst. That's not part of the strategy. So these are not sort of, so the difficulties, of course, to identifying what exactly should be done with the business. What is the root cause of the underperformance? It's not sufficient to understand that there's underperformance. You have to understand the root cause and what are the operational, strategic and structural things, people things that you should change in order to make that a great company. And AI is not going to be a competitor in that. AI will help us and help many of our companies, but will not be a competitor of what we're doing.
Very clear. And we're doing a series right now on how AI is changing investment process. So we may be extracting those two sentences and fusing them. So thank you very much indeed. Couple of general questions. Sweden, the great sporting nation, as well as a sort of a producer of so many extraordinary entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. What's the one sporting event that you haven't been to in the world that you would love to attend?
A sporting event I'd like to attend? I think that's probably going to be something where I participate. I was thinking about starting doing trail running. So maybe I should do trail running this summer in the mountains of Switzerland. And I'd rather do it than watch.
Right. Yeah. Well, we just did an interview with the head of Saudi Sports, and they're backing all sorts of sports like triathlons. Mm. Trail running wasn't one of them, but who knows? And finally, how would you, in 10 years' time, like to be judged?
Business-wise?
Yes.
Okay. I think if I look forward, it's quite interesting. I mean, it's quite amazing. We've been able to have the same strategy for 25 years, the same kind of team setup, the same geographical area, the same kind of companies. And we still have a situation where we have a lot of high value added and low competition in the business we do. And I think that's going to continue that way. So I think over the next 10 years is continue to refine, do the same thing. If we can, you know, if we can continue to help catalyze changes in companies and help them to become better, that will be a great benefit for, we'll continue to make very good returns, but it will also be good for society and the companies. That's what I want to achieve.
Well, I typically sum up, and one of the things that struck me as I've gone through the research process or listening to you now for a while is that, with the caveat that past performance is no guide to future performance, is that if I'm an allocator, our industry has sort of driven us into thinking about public equity and private equity, and there's certain buckets and, you know, nomenclatures, and you probably sit between buckets, which shouldn't matter if, after all, as an allocator, what you really care about is return. And so I'm struck that, you know, your unorthodoxy, you know, is a bit sort of, you know, is a bad reflection on our industry that wants to badge things, you know, in a
It was a
way.
Horror when we tried to raise our first fund. It was like, I tell you, that was a lot of hard work and very difficult to get it done. But we're quite happy that we're between buckets, because it makes it more difficult to copy what we're doing. And normally we speak on a CIO level to get with our investors and get them where they decide that even though we don't fit one of their buckets, they want to invest.
And the other two conclusions is that whilst we are all exist and have to perform in a relative world, you really think about the absolute requirement and expectation, you know, when you make these investments. And that, secondly, that the lack of, and it's not the lack of owners in the public market space, it's the lack of voice of those owners so often is doing a disservice to, you know, to other shareholders. And when we talked about that secondary effect at the beginning, is that, you know, firms like yours that are, you know, going to work, you know, there are, you know, further benefits that come from the flywheel when it, you know, when it works.
Yeah, I think there's the other shareholders of companies are investors. They're not owners. I mean, technically it's the same thing, right? You own shares, but they're not acting as owners. And that creates a void. And that void is even getting bigger, you know, with the index funds and other things that are happening in the market. So actually, the environment for us is just getting better and better in terms of there's this void we can fill as a real owner, where there are very few that act that way in the public markets. The second thing is that we can build on the reputation, the network, the contacts we have to be better, faster in implementing the changes we want to implement in companies.
Great. Well, Lars, it's taken us a little while to get you over from Switzerland into our studio. You've been somewhat elusive, I have to say, but I've been looking forward to it. And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you so much, Simon.